Hi, I'm thinking of getting another tattoo to go with my raging dragon one.
Sure. What are you looking for?
Well, maybe something like a...
Bunnies! He wants a row of bunny rabbits with twitchy noses.
Your vote is your voice, so don't let others decide for you.
All holding giant flowers.
Who's that?
Ella. She works in the bank next door.
Make sure you're registered to vote. Go to checktheregister.ie and be a voter so that it's your voice that's heard. From Am Comisiún Toghcháin, Ireland's Independent Electoral Commission.
Too cute. And write Sarah on it.
Cute? I'm a martial arts champion. And my boyfriend's name is Jack.
Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
I hope that they kind of keep it calm, keep it measured. I think if you get those things right, I think they've got the best potential and headroom in terms of how far they can go and what kind of performance they can deliver. They'll have a great day.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you like the Indo Daily, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on the Indo Daily, Mary Lou MacDonald, a Republican riddle.
Friends, building a new Ireland as a nation home for all our people isn't beyond us. The title of today's conference is Together We Can. We must move forward.
She is the most intriguing figure in Irish politics, attracting support across the island.
Friends, and so many of you have said to me quite correctly, you know, you've very big shoes to fill. Well, the truth is that no one will ever fill Gerry Adams' shoes. That's the truth.
But how well do we know the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald?
How did a person with a private school education like that turn up in the most unlikely position that she's in now, which is leader of Sinn Féin?
From her father's colourful background to her million-euro mansion and her rapid rise in politics, are there questions to be answered before she potentially becomes Taoiseach?
You know, she was fast-tracked through Sinn Féin at a rate of knots. I understood she had to do never turn your back on the armed forces. She and her husband bought a house. They then developed it into what I call a mansion. They spent large sums of money. And it is very difficult to understand where that money came from. I'd feel more comfortable about her becoming Taoiseach if she would dissociate herself from what the IRA did.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Shane Ross, author of Mary Lou MacDonald, A Republican Riddle.
Mary Lou MacDonald never wore a balaclava. She never pulled a trigger. She never planted a bomb. She has never even been in prison. Indeed, it's unlikely that she has ever incurred as much as a speeding fine. Today, she leads a party full of hardened IRA veterans. Some are still puzzled by her selection as leader of Sinn Féin. Others are pleased that she's...
Shane Ross, you look to, if not rewrite the narrative around Mary Lou MacDonald, very much fill in a lot of the blanks about her. And in that, her background, this kind of suggestion that she comes from a very well-to-do Southside Dublin background, and this is the whole fascination with her then heading up a Republican left-wing party. But you do shed light upon her family background and her, in particular, her father. Can you tell me a bit about Paddy MacDonald?
Yeah, Paddy MacDonald was a building contractor, and he was, as a very young man, he got married very young, and as a very young man working there, he was pretty successful, momentarily for a short period of time. He figures very much as a very colourful character, where he gets himself into quite a lot of scrapes and escapades. He had a very, very, very unfortunate accident around that time, and it did him a huge amount of damage, and he couldn't really practice as a building contractor anymore. And as a result of that, he took an action which lasted an awfully long time for various reasons, but it ended up with him in court on several occasions. And he got a settlement which was not nearly adequate enough for him, and he was really incapable of doing the work for which he was trained. He was wild. He was unorthodox. He got himself into all sorts of awkward situations, which were highlighted in the media at the time, but nobody knew who he was. And they're all actually detailed in the book. Most of them are out of the newspapers as well, where he was doing things which might have been embarrassing to a politician if her father was doing it, but she wasn't that at the time.
The accident actually seems to contribute a lot to the struggles that he has in his business world.
Yeah.
This all results in the marriage basically breaking up.
Well, I don't know. I mean, one thing I said to Mary Lou about when I met her and told her about this, I said I wouldn't cover any of the details of the marriage breaking up, which I think is fair enough. She didn't want me to, and I wouldn't do that. But it obviously, you could guess it was a contributory factor. He was drinking too much. He was not paying the rent. Sometimes his life was pretty chaotic, and so as a result of, and then the marriage did break up during that period of time, certainly, and his income went down to a very, very low level indeed, and he was drinking a lot, so his life was pretty chaotic, so it can't have been helpful to the marriage or the fact that he left in 1979, around there, I think. Yeah,
you detail a few colourful anecdotes as well. Tell us about the van with the Ben Briscoe election posters.
Okay, I'll tell you one.
Yes.
But only one, because there are lots. I'll tell you that one if you like. That's a very good one. That ended up on the front page of the Irish Independent. And what happened there was Paddy MacDonald, Mary Lou's dad, was a member of Infor. He turned up at election time, certainly, and he would tell people he campaigned for Ben Briscoe, he campaigned for Erskine Childers, and he was campaigning in the elections in 1973 for Brady and Jerry Buchanan and for Ben Briscoe.
Fianna Fáil's Ben Briscoe is the longest-serving member on Dublin City Council, re-elected at every poll since 1967. He's TD for Dublin South Central. He faced a lot of local opposition there when he voted in favour of the controversial Clanbrassil Street dual carriageway.
And he was driving the truck around with the posters on it, you know, which they do, and huge truck around. He parked it in, well, somebody parked it, I presume it was him who parked it, in an illegal place. The vehicle inspectors or patrollers, they were, found it parked in that. It was in Harold's Cross in Dublin, the constituency. And he came out from wherever he was, which I guess was a pub, but it may not have been. And he saw them taking it away, and he got straight in, and he protested with them, as did some of his fellows, about them taking it away. And it was, you know, it was all festooned in Fianna Fáil posters. They actually said, well, we're towing it away, we don't care. And he got in it, and he sat in it. And he said, okay, you're going to take me, basically take me too. And they did. And they towed him away. They towed him up to the pound, and they weren't care. Somebody paid the fine there and then, I think, so one of the Fianna Fáil troops. But there's this wonderful photograph of him, and it's in the book, and it's the front page of the Irish Independent on the 1st of March 1973, and it's headed "The Van Behind the Wire." Right, which is a really good caption, which the Irish Independent is good at, always has been. A van behind it. And inside, there's this thing which says compound. Inside the compound is this lorry with posters, Brady and Briscoe and Buchanan. And sitting in this van is this very young man at the time, who is basically wouldn't leave his car. That's what it was. So he was towed away. And that was one of the kind of scrapes that he was in. Now, he wasn't charged with anything that time, or et cetera. But there are a lot of situations like that. He was wild. He was very colourful.
And again, you explain how the notion that Mary Lou grew up in some form of lavish house in one of the most affluent suburbs.
Yeah.
Not quite.
No, this is the interesting thing. And I don't know whether it's good for her or bad for her that people should know this, but she lived in a very, very large house called Arna Grenier in Rathgar. And I used to hang around there because it was in my constituency in that area, and people say, oh, that's Mary Lou's house, right? And, you know, then they tell you, oh, yeah, she lived there, they were very well off, and et cetera. When I started researching the book, I found out that it was rented. It was an apartment. So I don't know what the size of their apartment was. Maybe it was a very large part of the house, no, but it was rented. So they didn't own their own house at all. And, you know, she did have a private education. Somebody had money to pay for that. Somebody had money to pay the rent, and the rent would have been reasonably high. But it wasn't as though they owned this massive mansion, which is, there's a photograph of it in the book. It's really grand house indeed. It was that they were renting part of this mansion, and sometimes the father couldn't pay the rent as well, because as a result of the accident, he wasn't working full time, and his business went under. And he afterwards, you know, which led to many other stories about him. He afterwards had many, many jobs. Indeed, some of them entertaining, some of them abroad, some of them landed him quite a lot of trouble.
So that's one of the riddles you point to. They're financially struggling, yet at the same time, there's kind of the facade is living in a big house, going to private school, and that's part of what doesn't add up.
Yeah, it doesn't quite add up. Now, they have this very, very, very responsible mother who's very conscientious, and Mary Lou is very close to her. You can tell that she was with her last weekend at the Three Arena. She brought her to the Ardesh where she was elected leader. So she's very close to her mother indeed, but not so close to her father. So that area of things doesn't really add up because there was no obvious source of income coming in regularly. I think it was sporadically coming in, but not at all. So going to a private school must have stressed her, and her brothers and sisters went to private school. Well, one of them went to a private school as well. You know, so that would have been pushed them very hard.
Now you know Mary Lou very well, largely speaking from your time in the Public Accounts Committee together. But so is this biography, is it authorised? Is it sanctioned? Is it with the cooperation of the subject?
No, it's not authorised at all. I asked her not to authorise it formally. I met her in May last year and told her what I was doing. And I asked her, you know, could she help in it? Actually, what I wanted her to do was to introduce me to members of her family. I thought that was the missing part, the really big missing part. Who is Mary Lou? Where's she come from? Nobody really knew anything about this. And it's all in there now, I think. And she, that was all I asked her, actually. I didn't want her to be authorised because it would be compromising. But she came back after about a week. She said she'd go away and think about it. And she came back after a week and said, no, I am not going to authorise it. I am not going to introduce you to members of my family or assist with it in any way. But she said, I won't stand in your way. So it's certainly not authorised. And if it had been, I guess it would have been a different type of book.
What was the attraction in writing a book about Mary Lou MacDonald, if that's not too obvious a question?
She's easily the most fascinating person in Irish politics by a country mile at this stage. I considered other people for biography, but no one came close to her because there were so many mysteries about her. Because there was, I mean, it's called a Republican riddle. And there were so many questions that should be asked, like, who is she? Where'd she go to school? How did a person with a private school education like that turn up in the most unlikely position that she's in now, which is leader of Sinn Féin, which is not a position which you would associate with a leader of Sinn Féin or a private school person. So all those things. But is she a convinced Republican? Why did she do it? Is she a politician of conviction or not? Because you have to ask that question when you see this very unlikely fit. So that was the first riddle. And, you know, there are lots of others, and I don't want to go around this in the wrong order. But, I mean, Fianna Fáil and her association there was a mystery. I knew that she had been there, but I didn't know what her extent of her commitment was, what Fianna Fáil had thought of her, why she left, all those things like that. And those were all things which are fascinating about her. And the final one is this, that nothing is predestined, but she's very much the favourite to be the next Taoiseach, as you know. And so that makes her very interesting. So she'd be the first woman ever Taoiseach, which is that, and the first Sinn Féin minister ever.
Do you think you've got to the bottom of that Republican riddle, how somebody from this background, in no way involved whatsoever in the Troubles, in fact, doesn't join Sinn Féin until after the Good Friday Agreement, rises to the top of the party, and also, therefore, is she in complete control of the party, or are there still the so-called shadowy figures in the background there running the show?
Well, I've got the reasons that she's given, and I've laid them out quite clearly in the book, and they're different from time to time, and they differ a bit. And I would have a view on whether they're all credible or not. I think it's probably, as in some cases, it's probably a combination of things. Conviction, maybe, on the Republican side. An experience for the hunger strikes, maybe.
Of my generation who saw those images from the H blocks
beamed into their homes, I think it changed all of us. I think it changed us whether we realised it or not. But for me, it was the precise moment that I, as a Dublin girl, realised how seriously wrong something was.
Meeting certain people at certain times in her life, so who've persuaded her that she should do certain things. I think the control thing is probably a different issue, whether she's controlled or not. But that is another question, which I would think we haven't totally answered yet. But if you were to ask me, is there still an army council? I would say that there are forces at work that are probably strong pressures, but there is no structure like it was. There's no military structure like it was. Even the SDLP say that it is in a reduced form. Now, they're pretty vague about that, but I think there is a feeling amongst opponents of Mary Lou that there are influences there which are still operating, and certainly probably they're stronger than the influence of normal political advisors. But to say there's an army council still now, there's not an armed threat to the state like there was before, and there's not a gun at Mary Lou's head or anything like that. But obviously she has to take account of the views of people who've fought for the IRA because they are still active in the party.
After spending, how long, 18 months?
Yeah, it's about 18
working
months.
Working on the book.
Yeah.
Do you feel you know the real Mary Lou McDonald better? Because you actually note at one point how you worked very closely with her on the Public Accounts Committee, but you said you never really went out socially or even semi-socially for coffees or any, yourself and other members.
Yeah.
It was always it's very professional, very, very business-like. You don't really get to know the personality behind it.
I mean, I thought I knew her then, and I now think I probably didn't and don't know her now. I like her. And what I see and meet and have known, I like a lot. And it's, you know, she's very engaging. She's very agreeable. She's very funny, very pleasant, very good manners, everything like that. And I think it was Killian Ford, who was her kind of sub for Europe and involved in the party with her and her assistants. He said that she's never knowable. To me, it's in the book as well. He says at the end of the day, she's got lots of facets to her personality, but she's not really knowable. And I think probably she keeps a kind of inner distant from everybody, whether she's got this really engaging outward personality. I don't know people who claimed, and have thought, I've met over 200 people in this, probably a lot more. I never came across anybody who said they really knew her very well. They know aspects of her. They meet her every day, maybe, but I don't think they can necessarily give you any huge insight into what really makes her tick. I mean, I think she's probably ambitious. Perfectly, you know, she was, you know, the stories of her at school are that she was a good but not much above average pupil, just a normal person. The stories of her at Trinity are that she was similarly, you know, she got a 2-1 degree, which is good but not brilliant. It's not. She was very, very normal. In political terms, she was absolutely disinterested till she was about 28, 29. So do I think I know her? No, I know the political side of her, a lot of which I disagree with. And I find her very agreeable and I have a good relationship with her, but not to the extent, as you say quite rightly, she never goes in the members' bar, she never goes into the restaurant. I never had a drink with her or anything like that, but lots of repartee and banter, yeah, of course.
And you say that working on the Public Accounts Committee, you feel that she became the star of the show there, yeah. And she very much became a personality in her own right, separate from her party.
Yeah, she was the only, obviously, Sinn Féin person on the Public Accounts Committee. And I was an independent, so we were kind of acting a bit in unison. I think it was John McGuinness who says as well, she was kind of separated from her party there because there was no republicanism on the PAC. There was no issue of the border or the economy, really. What she was doing was questioning accounting bodies, in other words, departments, secretaries general. And she was really good at that. And she was really good at getting information out of people and asking the right questions. She was really well briefed. But there was no real politics in it. I mean, the Public Accounts Committee is, in theory and sometimes in practice, apolitical in terms of political parties. You sit down there and you ask the questions to accounting officers about how they've governed basically their department, whether good or bad or other. And she was very, very good at that. But of course, it was an atmosphere which was completely free of political jousting. And so she could just get on with that. We didn't hear about the border. We didn't hear about United Ireland. We didn't hear about, socialism or feminism or any of those other things, which she's very strong on, or it's not very strong on socialism, but the party would be strong on. We just heard she was acting really rather like a lawyer in that situation and was very good at it.
I should say at the outset, just to declare my interest, I did postgraduate studies in the University of Limerick. So I'm certainly not going to question the excellence of your academic endeavours.
One of our most valued alumni.
Thank you so much. And flattery, Professor, will get you nowhere, as you will discover.
Can I put something to you, though, about that period? You talk about the successes that the Public Accounts Committee had under John McGuinness's chairmanship, bringing senior public officials to account, getting in particular in the wake of the crash. You had a lot of people in the Department of Finance and its remit coming in and bringing them to task. The issue about the Garda whistleblowers, and you detail how Mary Lou was very significant in that in her interrogation of the then Garda commissioner, and then the Central Remedial Clinic. And they were the successes. On the flip side, you'd have to say, Mary Lou McDonald also contributed to a number of other issues on the Public Accounts Committee. One being Angela Kearns going all the way to the Supreme Court, which found that the Public Accounts Committee acted unlawfully. Now, I know you say in your book that ruling had questionable merits, but yeah. It's the Supreme Court of Ireland.
Yeah,
so
sure.
The highest court in the land decided this. Also, in making allegations, in repeating allegations about people holding Ansbacher accounts on the floor of the Dáil, she was found to have abused Dáil privilege.
The whistleblower says that his investigation into Ansbacher accounts, offshore accounts and tax evasion was terminated by then-Minister Mary Harney in 2004, once Mr. Desmond O'Malley was discovered to be one of the holders of these accounts.
You can't be making allegations like that, please. You cannot make allegations of that nature in the chamber.
So, does she respect the institution of the Dáil, or does she see it as something to be used for political gain?
I suspect it's both, which is what all politicians probably feel. The Angela Cairns issue is an issue which I was involved in. That's right. I better make a confession fast. I was involved in that, and she and I and John McGuinness were not named, but were quite obviously singled out for breaking the rules by going beyond our remit. I wouldn't obviously agree with that decision, but it was a decision that was made. I would say just this, that politicians always go beyond their remit if they're allowed to, and that they go as far as they can beyond their remit. And if it was beyond their remit, I don't think you'd find that she or I or John would apologise for the questions that we asked. And the courts did find, they found, I think, that, we caused a lot of stress, which I would deeply regret if we did, but we did have to ask serious questions off her. And I think Mary Lou would agree with that. The issue of the Ansbacher accounts, yeah, I mean, I think she was wrong. I got a company with her on that. And just to explain it, an official in the department produced a document which named large number of people having Ansbacher accounts. And we all got copies of that document. And she decided to release it under privilege. I think that was wrong. I think it was irresponsible and it was unfair to the people involved, and they reacted pretty fiercely, and Mary Lou, being Mary Lou, and you have to like her for it as well, and even though it was the wrong thing to do, she took it on the chin and she refused to apologise and said, "Look, that's what the Dáil is for—to be producing evidence like that. We can't be produced anywhere else." And she held her head up high and basically gave two fingers to the committee. I think her decision was absolutely wrong. What she did. But it was typical of her not to retreat on it at all. That's what she did.
Now, you raise an issue of personal accountability for Mary Lou McDonald as well. And you say, basically, this issue will come up more and more if she becomes Taoiseach. This is the issue about the house.
Yeah.
The so-called Cabra Mansion.
Yeah.
Explain that and the finances behind it.
In shorthand, she and her husband bought a house in Cabra. It was a small bungalow. It was in drab condition. And they then developed it enormous into what I call a mansion, it was called a mansion before, I called it a mansion now, by another newspaper article, which is massively increased in size. And they spent a large sums of money on it. This is the issue here. It would be into several hundred thousand anyway. I got three estimates. They're in the book. And what I've said about that is that it is very difficult to understand where that money came from. I'm not saying there was anything untoward about it whatsoever. But what I'm saying is that they should, if she's going to become Taoiseach, she should present an account of where that money came from. I think it would be the right thing to do, because we're talking about very, very large sums of money, probably double the value of the house when it was bought as a bungalow, and undoubtedly double that, because there's no obvious source of it. It's never been spoken about. It's not to the credit of, I suppose, any of us or to the media that has really just passed by. I can't quite understand how that happened, but it did. It was I think there were two articles on it in a very, very shallow, not very shallow, I suppose, but just they didn't really address the issues except by saying, hey, look what this lovely big house Mary Lou has. But nobody actually went into it. And if they'd looked at the planning and the planning application, it's a massive planning application done by very, very expensive builders and architects, top grade. So you have to ask the question, where did the money come from? And that question has actually, to be fair to her, it's never been asked. So in any meaningful way, anyway. And I think that should be cleared up. Very definitely should be cleared up, because if people are going to, there've been accidents before for politicians or where houses have been involved, and I think it would be very helpful if she said, look, I won the lotto. I got a legacy from my grandmother or something like that. That's where it came from, because there's no evidence. Neither she nor Martin Lanigan and her husband were earning vast sums of money at the time. She was out of politics, actually. She hadn't even got a seat at that stage. And he was kind of middle ranking in Gas Networks Ireland. So there wasn't huge sources of supply at all that we know of. And neither of them have families which had an obvious source of wealth either. So I think it would be very helpful to say, look, that's how I afforded this. It certainly wasn't out of my income at the time. And it'd be just useful to say that. Otherwise, people will continue to ask questions.
Because, I mean, the argument could be, after getting married, they lived in a house in Stoneybatter. They were then out in Castle Knock. Building up equity, they moved on to a bigger house as their family is growing. And maybe there was savings on top. And what you're saying, there's just too big a gap.
Much too big a gap.
I mean, you're saying that they best bought the house for about $500,000, and the renovation works. Yeah, the renovation works could range anything up to $500,000 as well.
Could be
on top of that.
Could be more. The bungalow was $517,000 in very bad order. So they knew when they bought it they were going to have to do something to it. But they sold a house which wasn't. They sold a house out in Riverswood and Castle Knock, which was probably valued a little less than the one they bought. So they weren't going to get a huge amount out of that. So it's just very difficult to say where the money came from. You wouldn't get a mortgage of $500,000 with a very low income. And so that is, it's a big question mark. And I think maybe there's a perfectly obvious explanation, but I think politicians should, if they've got signs of such wealth, they should have to explain it. And normally they do. But first of all, she was out of the door at the time. And secondly, if she held cash or anything like that, she doesn't have to declare it. Cash doesn't count. So it would be better if she just came out and said, look, this is where the money came from.
What was the most surprising thing you came across in your research about Mary Lou?
Oh, I suspect the father and the background were fairly staggering, which is in her favour, I suppose, because she, despite the difficulties she had as a child, she's emerged as what appears to be a very balanced and very intelligent and unaffected, untraumatised person. I think on the positive side, I think she does have political principles, and it would be unfair to suggest she doesn't. That there's obviously an element of opportunism there, maybe massive. I don't know, but there were times when, again, Killian Ford said, who was no friend of hers in the end, he said she was very strong when people on the doorstep, when Sinn Féin people were trying to exploit the immigration issue, she wouldn't allow it. That's kind of quite admirable. I was on the negative side, I suppose. The thing that disappointed me most, and therefore disappointed, was the amount of time she spent in Northern Ireland going to commemorations, the amount of time that she spent trying to do the bidding of Gerry Adams without question, without querying him, you know, basically parroting him in some of his worst statements and defending him in his least defensible deeds. I thought that was really very disappointing indeed, and I wasn't aware of it, but it was, you see what she was doing there? She was basically campaigning for the leadership, and she was covering herself with the hard men in the North at this stage. This went on from, you know, very particularly coming up 2018, 15, 16, 17, 18. She was up at commemoration after commemoration to ingratiate herself with the men who'd fought for the IRA up there. I found that, you know, disappointing, but, you know, she's got a good side as well.
And what about this justification of the Provisional IRA's campaign? Do you find any reservations on her part? I mean, she'd nothing to do with that period of the party's history. She comes from a very different political background, herself, and yet doesn't really seem to blink an eye at the idea of saying the IRA's campaign was justified.
So what's your relationship with the IRA then? These people that George Hamilton says are still out there, still wielding influence. What's your relationship with them?
I have no relationship with the IRA. I've never been a member of the IRA. I'm a Sinn Féin person, and I am the leader of Sinn Féin. I was democratically elected to this position. We are an open democratic party, and nobody dictates the pace to me.
That's the deal when you go into Sinn Féin, I think, isn't it? You know, she was fast-tracked through Sinn Féin at a rate of knots. Didn't have to go through any of the usual kind of hoops. And it's quite obvious that the real sine qua non, I mean, what she was told or understood she had to do, never turn your back on the armed forces. That's it. I mean, that applies to every member of Sinn Féin as far as I can see. And she stood by it. Now, you could see when she was taking certain positions that she probably didn't share them really, and she wasn't convinced of them, and as all politicians do. It's somewhat different, I suppose, in her case, because you're not condemning murder. In other politicians' case, you go along with what you don't agree with, but you're basically just voting against your conscience or your beliefs. And I think that is something which is held against her, and rightly held against her, or remembered by her opponents. They say, look, condemn these awful murders, and she won't do it. And that is, you know, she'll fudge around and say she regrets they happened, but she will not. And there's a whole chapter about the ones she didn't condemn, the ones which awful the situations. You know, she says she stood by Adams on saying that Slab Murphy is a good Republican when she obviously didn't look comfortable doing it, but she did it.
And were you satisfied with her reaction to allegations of sex abuse by members of the IRA?
No, this is another one. I mean, the Maria Cahill case was just appalling. And she was in the door the day that they gave, I think it was 4 hours, to discussion of Maria Cahill's case. And it was just a terrible story. She sat beside Gerry Adams throughout, and she parroted his line and the IRA's, or the IRA Sinn Féin's line on that. And she didn't veer from it for a moment, which is extraordinary for a woman.
In light of these, we call them judgment calls on her part, would you have concerns about her becoming Taoiseach in light of everything that you know about her now?
I'd feel more comfortable about her becoming Taoiseach if she would dissociate herself from what the IRA did and make credible demonstration that she's not in any sense still in the hands of people who still support the idea of violence. I think I'd feel much more comfortable. You know, the question people ask is, are they Democrats? Behind it all, people say is, okay, she'll come and she'll form a cabinet, but, you know, are the institutions of the state going to be used in a way which they shouldn't be? You can't really fight too much with a Democratic mandate. And you have to realize, obviously, that young people don't care as much as we do about that, because we remember. But I think I'd feel more comfortable because she's kind of in the middle there, and she's been subjected to influences from both sides. And whatever her instincts may be, She may be compelled, if there are still powerful people in the background, she may be compelled to respond to that. I think that would be a pity, and I think it might be dangerous.
Would you vote for Mary Lou McDonald?
That's a very good question.
It's hypothetical. You don't live in her constituency.
If she moves
to Cabra next week, would you vote for her?
I'd take a bit of convincing to do that. If I was convinced that she had broken all links with people who have undemocratic intentions and were not still involved in any way in doing things which were not democratic, I wouldn't say never, you know. She's very able. She's probably a bit left for me, but I'm not sure that she's really left at all. But if you've got to be certain that she is absolutely committed to democracy, and then you could consider it. But, you know, if she's not, she's a different type of politician.
And my thanks to Shane Ross for joining me today. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of The Indo Daily was produced by Garrett Mulhall, with sound by Gavin Hennessy. Archive clips from RTE, BBC, UTV, and independent.ie. If you enjoy The Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow, and leave us a review.